Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 19. I'll call this chapter Job Replies to Bildad. My Redeemer lives. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Bildad is unloaded on Job for the second time. Bildad the Shuhite has done that. And he basically said, God punishes the wicked, and you are wicked, Job. You are evil. You are a sinner. And he's been pretty brutal about it. No more comfort at all. No more professed comfort in the words of Job's false friends. So we start now in Job 19, 1 through 3, and we see how Job responds to Bildad. Then Job responded, how long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you have insulted me, you are not ashamed to wrong me. Now, in our last chapter, Bildad has talked to his two other false friends, and he tells them, Eliphaz and Zophar, how long will you hunt for words? Show understanding, and then we can talk. In other words, there's no point in arguing with this guy. But, of course, the other two were not interested in ending their speeches. They were not interested in stopping their criticisms of Job. And so Job sort of picks up on that, and he says, okay, Bildad, how long will you torment me? You're wondering how long Eliphaz and Zophar can go. How long can you go and keep tormenting me? How long will you crush me with words? Now notice that old saying, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That is an absolute lie. As Job points out here, Bildad's words are crushing him. They're not bouncing off of him. It's real easy to forget Job's mental torment by focusing on his physical torment. Remember, these were Job's close friends, and they're just blasting him, telling him that he is a wicked, evil sinner. Job says in verse 3, these 10 times you have insulted me. This is not, of course, literal. The expression 10 times was commonly used as a synonym for often or many, or sometimes as a round number, as Gill, Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all agree. Here's an example, Genesis 31:7. Jacob is speaking to Rachel and Leah, and he says this, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. Well, he didn't change their wages precisely 10 times. It just means he's done it over and over again. Ecclesiastes 7:19, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. 10 rulers just means a lot of rulers. It's just like the Chinese have a number 10,000, yuan, 10,000. It means lots and lots and lots. It doesn't mean literally 10,000. As Mao Zedong said, he was quoting somebody else, I forgot who, the journey of 10,000 Chinese miles begins with one step. He didn't mean that the journey was actually 10,000 miles. And so what Job is saying here is, you keep insulting me. You're not even ashamed to wrong me and insult me. Again, Job is still maintaining his innocence, as he has all the way through this drama. We go now to Job 19, verses 4 through 6. Job says this, even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me. If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. He says in verse 4, even if I have truly erred, that is a concession only for the sake of argument. Job does not actually believe he has erred. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown introduce a subtlety of the language. The Hebrew expression here for erred means unconscious error. So what Job is saying, even if I have truly erred unconsciously, I haven't done it consciously. My error lodges with me. The NIV says, my error remains my concern alone. In other words, as Gill and Clark say, why do you, Bildad, concern yourselves with tormenting me? It's my mistake. It's my error. It's between me and God. You're not going to listen to me. I'm not listening to you. Why don't you just shut up? Why do you have to keep on and on about this? And then in verse 5, Job says, if indeed you vaunt yourself against me, in other words, if indeed you win the argument, well, that just proves that God is unjust. Know then that God has wronged me because I didn't do anything wrong. If you prove that I'm a sinner because I'm suffering, well, then God has wronged me because I didn't do anything to deserve this suffering. Now, notice that Job, all the way through this drama, has always ascribed his sufferings to God. He never blames Satan on his suffering, which I think is kind of interesting. It seems to me that the idea of God allowing Satan to try Job is something that Job hadn't thought of, despite the fact that's exactly what's happening, as we know from chapter 1. Job hadn't figured that out yet. But nonetheless, Job is saying, as Clark puts it, God hasn't commissioned you, Bildad, to add your reproaches to what God has done. You could prove that God has wronged me, but that's between God and me. You don't have any right to make things worse, prove my disgrace. Now, why does Job in verse 6 say that if Bildad wins the argument, then God has wronged Job? Well, that's because on the basis of Bildad's false theology, God did not act justly, because God would be punishing an innocent man, Job, and therefore God would then be wrong on the basis of your false theology, Bildad the Shuhite. So Job is not letting Bildad get away with his argument for 1 minute. He can't explain why he's suffering, but by golly, he's not going to admit that he did anything to deserve this suffering. We go down to Job 19, verses 7 through 10. Job continues, "Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has put darkness on my paths. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone, and he has uprooted my hope like a tree." Again, Job is looking for an answer. Why, God? Why? Verse 7, Job cries violence. In other words, violence is happening to me. My world's come crashing down, but I get no answer. I need an answer. Now, why is God sometimes silent when we cry for help? The NIV Study Bible puts it this way, a little bit sanctimoniously, but this is what they say, quote, "The short answer might be that God's silence can deepen our faith. The long answer is that we don't know. God's silence has puzzled his people from the earliest times until now. God, even in his matchless love for his people, sometimes allows us to drift seemingly alone." Well, that's the old dark night of the soul that all the Christian mystics used to talk about. I mean, Jesus is our example, and Jesus on the cross said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" We will feel forsaken sometimes, but God doesn't ever forsake us. He never forsake Jesus on the cross. He's not going to forsake you either. Might seem like it, but he's not going to do that. The point is, we have to hold on. We have to have the patience of Job, or the endurance of Job, until God gets us through our trial and restores all our stuff at the end of the book. But Job is looking for an answer in verse 7, and he can get none. There's two things that Job couldn't get. He couldn't get his friends to justify his past character, and he couldn't get God to end his sufferings. So he's pretty miserable. God's walled him up, put darkness on his path, stripped his honor from him, removed the crown from his head. What does the crown mean? Could be his wealth, as in Proverbs 14:24. The crown of the wise is their riches. Or it could be his children and descendants, Proverbs 17:6. Grandchildren are the crown of old men. John Gill says it could refer to an earthly crown, a temporal crown. Job was some kind of a sheik who had lost his crown there as he ruled in his tribe in the desert. I don't think so. I just think it means his honor and glory has been stripped from him. Verse 10, God breaks Job down on every side. He says, "I'm gone." I like that. I'm gone. I'm out of here. Getting ready to die. God has uprooted my hope like a tree. This would be in retort to Zophar in Job chapter 11. Zophar says this, "Then you would trust because there is hope, and you would look around and rest securely." In other words, if you would confess your sin, Job, you would hope. Job says, "No, I don't have any hope. God has uprooted my hope like a tree. I can't confess a sin I didn't do." We go now to Job 19, verses 11 through 12. Job continues, "He," referring to God, "has also kindled his anger against me and considered me as his enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my tent." Now, the question Job might ask is, why is God considering Job, who is the friend of God, why is God now considering him as his enemy? Well, objectively, God is not Job's enemy. Job just thinks he is. He feels like God is his enemy. As the NIV Study Bible puts it, these are words of feeling, not fact. Job felt like an enemy of God, but God had not deserted him. We have the good fortune of knowing the beginning of the story, that God delights in Job, chapter 1, verse 8, chapter 2, verse 3, and that Job's actual enemy is the accuser, Satan. See, Job didn't know that. We know it, but Job did not know it. So Job didn't know the beginning of the story, that it was Satan that's coming after him, and he didn't know the end of the story, that God's going to restore all of his stuff. Well, we now proceed into a section which has lots of allusions to warfare, invasion, battles, sieges, and so forth, from verses 7 to 13. Well, we've already actually gone through that. So we go now to Job 19, verses 13 through 16. J. Job continues, "He, that's God, has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. I am a foreigner in their sight. I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth." I mean, Job sunk so low he can't even get his servants to answer him. Verse 13, Job says, "God has removed my brothers far from me." His brothers means his nearest kinsmen. It doesn't necessarily mean his blood brothers. There's a contrast there. Verse 13, God has removed Job's brothers. And at the end of verse 13, "and my acquaintances are completely estranged." So he's doing it the Hebrew way, hitting all possibilities. Close people and people who are mere acquaintances, they're all gone from me. It doesn't matter. They all hate me. Now, why would Job's family and friends abandon him? Here's what the NIV Study Bible says, quote, "Some can't handle the intense environment. They don't want to be around pain and suffering. It's too uncomfortable. Others have little sympathy and hear everything as whining. Still others leave perhaps because they think the sufferer deserves what has happened." Oh, it's not easy to be around pain and suffering, I'll tell you. It's not easy at all. And Job's friends and family are not treating him like somebody who's suffering and needs help. They just ignore him, treat him like a stranger. Can't even get his servant to answer him, has to yell at him. They are estranged, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. That estranged means that they, quote, literally, quote, turn away with disgust. We go now to Job 19, verses 17 through 20. Job continues, "My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children despise me. I rise up, and they speak against me. All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth." All right, the first phrase, "my breath is offensive to my wife," Job says. Well, that can mean his words are offensive to his wife. It could mean that literally his breath smelled because of his disease, and that's the way I take it. Or it could be his spirit, his breath is his spirit, is offensive to his wife because his attitude is bad. He's complaining all the time, and she's tired of it. I like to take that one literally. His breath stinks. That's how low he's sunk. "I am loathsome to my own brothers." He's one big boil, and people look at all that pus and say, oh, yuck. "Even young children despise me." They say, look at the old man sitting there in his disease. You know, kids can be cruel, and so they're cruel to Joel. "All my associates abhor me. Those I love have turned against me." He doesn't have any friends anymore. Even his wife, his own breath is offensive to his wife, so his wife won't even talk to him because his breath stinks. The person closest in all the world to him has abandoned him. In verse 20, Job says, "My bone clings to my skin and my flesh." Now, if you think about that a little bit, your skin and your flesh are wrapped tight. They cling to the bone. That means there's no flesh there. There's no fat. And Job is looking like a gaunt skeleton. Bone clings to the skin and the flesh, which makes the outline of the bone stand out through the skin and the flesh. And Job uses an expression we use a lot. Job says, "I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth." Could be translated as the NIV note says, "I have escaped only by my gums." Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown takes that as the skin of my gums. Adam Clark says, "The skin of my teeth means the enamel of my teeth." John Gill says it could mean, "I've escaped only by my lips." The skin of my teeth is referring to the lips because your lips put a layer of skin over your teeth when your mouth is shut. I think it's easier just to say the skin of my teeth is the enamel on the edge of your teeth, and that's very thin compared to the rest of the teeth, and so that means you barely escaped. And what he means, Job is saying, I'm barely alive. I've escaped only by the skin of my teeth. I'm just barely alive. John Gill says that in this expression, some speculate that Satan spared Job's mouth, lips, and teeth so Job could curse God. I think that's a very big speculation. Job is just saying here, I'm barely alive. So now we go to Job 19, verses 21 through 24. Job continues, pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does, and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. And Job says twice, pity me, pity me. Adam Clark says the reiteration of the word pity shows the depth of Job's sorrow. He's miserable here, and you can really feel it now. And Job still calls him his friends. Pity me, O you my friends. It's amazing to me that Job would still call them friends after the way they've treated him. For the hand of God has struck me. Nothing worse than to be struck by the hand of God. Why do you persecute me as God does? Listen, if God's going to be against me, that's one thing, but why do you have to be against me too? Are you not satisfied with my flesh? Job is already suffering physically. Aren't you satisfied with that as being enough suffering for me? And now you're depriving me of my social existence, my friendships. My family is gone. My associates are gone. My acquaintances are gone. And now you, my friends, are gone. You're not giving me any comfort. It's bad enough that I am physically suffering, but what about my mental anguish? Now, when Job says, are you not satisfied with my flesh? I just assume that meant his physical suffering, but it could also mean his children, which are bone of his bones and flesh of his flesh. His children are his flesh. He's lost them. And so he could be saying, aren't you satisfied that I've suffered enough because my children are all gone? John Gill takes it this way. He says, quote, Job's flesh was ulcerated from head to feet and was clothed with worms and clods of dust. They were not content that his children, the friends, were not content that Job's children, which were his own flesh, were torn away from him and destroyed. Now, in verse 22, Job says, why do you persecute me as God does? That sounds like God striking Christ. And so some people say that Job is a type of Christ. I think this is a little bit of a stretch, but I'll mention it to you. We read in Psalm 69, verse 26, for they have persecuted him whom you yourself have smitten, and they tell of the pain of those whom you have wounded. Well, persecuted him who you yourself have smitten sounds a lot like Isaiah 54 and 55. God has smitten Christ, according to this view. And, of course, the psalmist is complaining about somebody who is persecuting whom God has smitten. It's one thing for God to smite somebody, but then you persecute the smitten one? That's not good for humans to afflict those whom God has afflicted. We read in Zechariah 1:15, but I am very angry with the nations who are at ease, for while I was only a little angry, they furthered the disaster. So God can punish, but don't you add to the punishment. And so Job is saying, I'm being struck, even as Jesus was struck by God. I don't believe that that's what Job is getting at. I don't believe that's a type of Christ, but I bring it up for the sake of completeness. Now in verse 23, Job says, oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Verse 24, that with an iron stylus and lead, they were engraved in the rock forever. Now what Job is looking for here is for some permanence so that he just doesn't go buzzing off into the universe, into death, with no justification and no vindication. Perfectly understandable emotion. Now, what words is Job talking about? Well, it could be the transactions of his life to prove with what integrity he had lived. The words could be the defense he has just given to his friends, as we've seen all the way through the book of Job so far. I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. He wants to put those words of innocence down in a book or on a rock so that posterity could judge him and see that he was right in his cause. Or the words he's talking about is the words he is about to deliver. He hasn't delivered them yet, but he's about to, when he's going to say, I know that my Redeemer lives. John Gill says Job is expressing his faith in Christ, in the resurrection of the dead, and in a future state of happiness and glory. That's debatable, but that's what Gill says that Job was doing, and Job wants to write it down. It could be all of the above. It could just be everything. Job wants some permanence. He wants people to know the truth, that he was not guilty. Verse 24, Job says, with an iron stylus and lead, I wish that the words were engraved in the rock forever. Now, the NIV Study Bible says concerning the stylus and lead, quote, the precise meaning is uncertain. Apparently, Job wanted his words engraved on a monument of some sort so that his case could be judged later by others whom he deemed more honest than his friends. Specifically, how iron tools were used to inscribe on lead or rock is not clear. And there's also a translation problem. It could be inscribed with lead or on lead, as John Gill points out. And I'm not going to worry about how this was actually done. It's absolutely irrelevant to the main point. Now, Job in verse 24 wants his words engraved in a rock forever, or in the rock forever. Remember that word forever. When you see it in the Old Testament, it does not necessarily mean for every last millisecond of eternity. It could mean just for a long time. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown put it, for as long as the rock lasts. Doesn't mean forever and ever and ever and ever, a world without end. However, I must say this. It is ironic that Job's words are still around 4,000 years later. As a matter of fact, you are listening to those words right now. You and I are talking about Job's words 4,000 years later. So Job really got his wish there. We turn now to the key verses in this chapter, Job 19, verses 25 through 27. Job says this, "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. My heart faints within me." Now, verse 25, Job says, "I know that my Redeemer lives," capital R. Who that Redeemer is, of course, is argued about. The NIV note says it can be translated defender. "I know that my defender lives." We'll just take it as Redeemer. Now, let me preface this discussion with a statement from Adam Clark. Quote, "Any attempt to establish the true meaning of this passage is almost hopeless. By learned men and eminent critics, the words have been understood very differently, some vehemently contending that they refer to the resurrection of the body and the redemption of the human race by Jesus Christ, while others, with equal vehemence and show of argument, have contended that they refer only to Job's restoration to health, family comforts, and general prosperity after the present trial should be ended. In defense of these two opinions, larger treatises have been written than the whole book of Job would amount to, if written even in capitals." Well, with that pessimistic introduction, I will say that I don't believe that Job is concerned about the resurrection of the dead. I know you cannot prove the resurrection of the dead from this section, verses 25 through 27, as I'm going to show you. However, it does show that Job believed in an afterlife. He believed in heaven. Maybe not a physically resurrected body in heaven, but he did believe in heaven. So of these two general opinions that Adam Clark suggests, that it's referring to being redeemed by Jesus at the end of the world with the resurrection of the body, option one or option two, it means at the end of Job's life, he's going to see his trial over with and he's going to be redeemed from his misery. I like option two the best. And we need to realize that whichever option you take, Job is speaking prophetically and truthfully, as Adam Clark says, because the occurrence of either case, either getting raised from the dead or getting relieved from all of his temporal misery, the occurrence of either one of those events was highly improbable and or unheard of, and yet Job confidently proclaimed that it was going to happen. He never lost his faith in God. Now, who is this Redeemer that Job expects to see? Who is this Redeemer that Job confesses confidently who lives? Who is he? Well, the first option, of course, is Jesus. We used to think of, you know, our Redeemer lives. We think of Jesus as our Redeemer. But this is the Old Testament. Job's never heard of Jesus. I don't think he's referring to Jesus. Here's option number two mentioned by Adam Clark. Job is referring to his kinsman Redeemer. "I know that my kinsman Redeemer lives, and he is going to ransom my lost inheritance. He's going to pay me for all the stuff that was lost. He's going to buy me out of my poverty," in other words. Arguing for that is, Job says, "from my flesh I shall see God." In other words, from the activities of my kinsman Redeemer, my flesh. He's of my flesh, and he's going to keep my name going. He'll marry my widow, have some kids for me. I really don't think that's the answer. Job doesn't sound like he's referring to a third-person kinsman Redeemer. He says, "I shall see God," I myself, not through the efforts of my kinsman Redeemer, but "I myself so shall see God." And seeing God means not seeing him physically, but seeing the effects of what God does, seeing his deliverance, in other words. Doesn't sound like a kinsman Redeemer to me, but that's interesting. Adam Clark mentioned that. I thought I'd run it by you. Here's another option. God is Job's Redeemer. He is going to redeem Job's life by making sense out of all this suffering, and that's the option I believe that is correct here. Job is referring to God as his Redeemer, this same God who shut him out, who's locked him up, who's snuffing out his lights in his tent, who's making his life miserable. He said, yeah, he's making my life miserable, but I know that he lives. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that there's a problem with taking this view that the Redeemer is God. And the argument, which is taken up also by Adam Clark, the argument is that Job didn't seem to have any conviction that he would live. And so now he's saying, my Redeemer's going to take care of me when all this is over, and I'm still going to live and live to see it. And Adam Clark mentions a bunch of scriptures, which I will read to you to show you how despairing Job was. But as I read these scriptures, I think we need to remember Job is depressed, but deep down inside, he knows that God, his Redeemer, lives, and God's going to redeem him from all this mess. He's going to see God. Even when his skin is destroyed, God's going to somehow deliver him from this mess. Well, let's look at Job's depressing statements. Job 6:11, what strength do I have that I should continue to hope? What is my future that I should be patient? Job 7:21, why not forgive my sin and pardon my transgression? For soon I will lie down in the grave. You will eagerly seek me, but I will be gone. Job's talking to his false friends. Job 17:11 through 15, my days have slipped by. My plans have been ruined, even the things dear to my heart. They turned night into day and made light seem near in the face of darkness. Talking about his false friends. If I await Sheol as my home, the grave, spread out my bed in darkness and say to corruption, you are my father, and to the maggot, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Job 19:10, God tears me down on every side so that I am ruined. He uproots my hope like a tree. Job 7, verse 7, remember that my life is but a breath. My eye will never again see anything good. Job 30:23, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house of meeting for all living. Job is one depressed son of a gun. But in the middle of all that depression, he says, I know my Redeemer lives. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God. Now in verse 25, Job says, at the last. What does he mean by at the last? John Gill suggests during Jesus' earthly ministries, in these last days God has spoken to us and his sons, Hebrew 1:10. No, that's not. Job doesn't know anything about Jesus' ministry. At Jesus' resurrection, Gill suggests, at the last, at Jesus' resurrection, God, or Jesus, the Redeemer, I guess the Redeemer would be Jesus, not God, will take his stand on the earth. Again, I don't believe that's what Job's talking about there, as nice as that thought is. Or John Gill also suggests that God, that the Redeemer will take his stand on the earth at the end of time, when Jesus has everything presented to him and all everything is all in all. I don't think it refers to any aspect of Jesus' life. I think it refers to the end of Job's life. I don't have a commentator backing me up on that, but I really believe that's what he's talking about. At the last, God will take his stand on the earth or on the land, Job's land, and he's going to redeem Job from all this misery, and he's going to prove that his false friends are wrong as they can be. And Job is saying in verse 26, even after my skin is destroyed, even though I don't have anything left, not even my own skin, yet even still from my flesh, in other words, from my body, even though I don't have any skin, even though I'm covered with boils, nonetheless, I, living in a human body, am going to see God redeem me from this mess. I myself shall behold this Redeemer, God, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. I'm going to be looking at him and nobody else to get me out of this mess. Now, one little note about verse 25 before we hit verse 26. Verse 25 says, at the last he will take his stand on the earth. The NIV note says, at the last he will take his stand upon my grave. The same idea. He's not going to let Job go to the grave before he redeems him from all of Job's mess. Now, let's go to verse 26. This is the verse that many people say prove the resurrection of the dead. I believe in the resurrection of the dead, but I don't believe this verse proves it. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God. The problem with this is that there are textual variations here that make it difficult to be dogmatic in saying that Job believed in a personal fleshly resurrection. For example, the NIV note has a translation, and after I awake, though this body has been destroyed, then I shall see God. Well, it says after ye awakes, ye shall see God. But doesn't say anything about physical resurrection of the dead. It says, though this body has been destroyed, that says nothing about it being resurrected, according to that translation, or according to that textual variant. And to show you how the problem continues, let's look at this little preposition in verse 26. Yet from my flesh I shall see God. Well, that's the NASB. That sounds like Job is saying, oh, after I'm dead, after my skin is destroyed, clothed in my flesh, from the vantage point of my flesh, I shall see God. Well, that means he has to be in a resurrected body, does he not? Does it not? Sounds like it, but there's a problem there. That preposition from might not be translated from. The NIV note has apart from. So it would be translated, yet apart from my flesh, I shall see God. Well, that's exactly the opposite of a resurrection of the body. Apart from my flesh, in other words, in my disembodied state, I shall see God. So that doesn't help the case for the resurrection of the dead there at all. And in fact, if we look at the American Standard Version, the ASV, we read this, and after my skin, even this body is destroyed, then without my flesh shall I see God. Without my flesh, outside of my flesh, without my flesh, not having my flesh, that's the absolute opposite of the resurrection of the dead. So there's enough ambiguity here that you cannot dogmatically say that Job believes in the resurrection of the dead here. Now, I wish you could. I was involved in a fairly long battle with hyperpreterist heretics who deny the physical fleshly resurrection of the believer. And I thought, boy, this would be a good verse to use against those heretics. But then when I looked at it, I realized, oh, can't use it. This is what the NIV Study Bible says, and I think this is a good way to summarize the whole issue. Quote, he, quote, talking about Job probably had a general hope of life beyond the grave. It's uncertain, though, whether he thought in terms of a physical resurrection as taught later in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 15. Job merely expressed a strong confidence that somehow, somewhere, he would meet God face to face, which are my sentiments exactly. Let's show in Job 30, verse 23, that Job did believe in life after death. Maybe not a physical resurrection, but he did believe in life after death. Job 30, verse 23, for I know, Job is speaking, that you, God, will bring me to death and to the house of meeting for all living. You will bring me to death, and yet I will be in a house for all the living. That's life after death, folks. In Job chapter 30, Job has no hope in temporal deliverance. He's talking about after he dies. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Job does believe in life after death, just not necessarily belief in a resurrection, although he may have. It just depends on which is the correct translation and which is the correct textual variant. We go now to Job 19, verses 28 through 29, and we will finish this chapter. Job continues, if you say, how shall we persecute him? The you there is not God. Now he's talking to his three false friends. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment. What Job is saying, look, you want to persecute me? You want to find ways to persecute me? You live by the sword, you die by the sword. Verse 29, then be afraid of the sword for yourselves. You're going to whack me with your swords? Well, one day God's going to whack you. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword. What wrath? The wrath of God against you? So that you may know there is judgment. You're not going to get away with all this false accusation of me. God's going to come after you, and you're going to pay the price. You who keep talking about God always punishes sin. Well, yes, he does. And he's going to punish your sin. Now, some interpret verse 28 differently. Verse 28 says, if you say, how shall we persecute him? Job speaking to the three false friends. Some translate it this way, oh, how did we persecute him? Alas, we are now convinced that he did wrong, that we did wrong in persecuting Job. Seeing that the root of the matter is in him, in other words, seeing that Job understands what's going on. Well, there you have the three false friends just caving in completely to Job, and that's not true. Job is not saying that my false friends are seeing it my way now, because he says in verse 29, then be afraid of the sword for yourselves. Judgment's coming on you guys. So no, they're still holding out that he's a sinner. Job shows no joy at his friends' repentance here, because there is no repentance. That's a bum translation. I don't know who actually does that, but I read it in one of my commentators. So, ladies and gentlemen, Job is firing back at his false friends. He says the wrath of God is coming after you. And now it could be the wrath of the three friends against Job, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. In other words, in verse 29, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword. What Job could be saying, the wrath of you three guys against me is going to bring punishment from God, punishment of the sword. Could be. I just think it's easy to say it's the wrath of God's coming on you, hit on you guys. Why is this wrath coming? So that you may know that there is judgment. The NIV note says, so that you may come to know the Almighty, which is the same thing. You know the Almighty in judgment. Now, of course, that's not the last judgment. And note that Job is not wishing vengeance on his friends. He's talking about judgment in this particular case. Job's not wishing vengeance on his friends. He's merely stating a fact. You keep judging me wrongly like this, and God is going to get you for that, as the old country song says. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Job chapter 19. We are thus prepared to go in our next audio to Job chapter 20, which is also 29 verses long, and we will listen to the same old bilge from Zophar. The wicked will suffer. And Job, you're wicked and you're going to suffer. I hope you stay tuned with me for that nauseating diatribe by Zophar, and I hope you enjoyed this more elevating discourse by our friend Job.